afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another recording. Welcome to another episode. Today, I think I'm recording episode number 4 today, but overall, I think we're up to 193, I think, if memory serves me correctly. And today, we have a distinguished guest with me today. He brings decades of localization experience to the table, over 20 years at Microsoft, where he worked as on global launches of some of the most widely used products in the world, Windows, Skype, and Microsoft Teams. He's also an educator, having taught localization and CAT tool courses at the University of Washington, the City University of New York, and Montclair University, NYU. He is an author with two books in his name, The Little Book of Language, Languages, that's one, and The Little Book of Localization, that's another one. He's currently serving as a localization director at Translation Commons, where he coordinates volunteer localization initiatives that supports language access and minority language communities. And on top of all that, he's contributing to the Mayan Language Preservation Project. That's what attracted me to this conversation. Explore beyond your impressive history and credential and CV, Soren. That was one of the projects that I would like to engage and talk about today. And he's exploring currently how synthetic data generation can help build machine translation for under-resourced languages like the Kwikchi, if I pronounced that correctly. Soren Eberhardt, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat. Great to have you with me. I can't wait to get to know you and get to know what you do. Thank you so much for joining
me. Well, thank you so much for having me. And I'm looking forward to the conversation as much as you do, Robin.
I really appreciate it. Now, as we say on this channel, Soren, everybody's got a story. What's your story?
My story is that I love languages, and I feel that everybody who's in the language industry has the privilege of tackling a problem that in itself is beautiful. I love to travel. I like to see that people around the world are different, using different languages, using digital products in slightly different ways, having different cultural norms, but then being able to take products and bring them to these different markets and figuring out, like, how do we best translate things? How do we best maybe even add features and marketize products? How do we deal with cultural sensitivities? How do we not offend our users? So I feel like it's a beautiful problem, and it's fun to tackle that problem. And as I've been, you mentioned that I've been with, that I was with Microsoft for 20 years. There's still a big divide between those languages that the language industry has been doing a really good job in figuring out how to address that particular problem of bringing products to those markets. And then there's language communities where we haven't been doing such a great job.
Take us back, if you don't mind, Soren, to 1997. What pulled you into the localization industry, and what did the localization industry even look like back then compared to today?
So I had no idea that there was something called localization.
Same here.
I have a master's in comparative literature, linguistics, and philosophy. And quite frankly, it was mere chance that got me involved in localization. I started actually as a proofreader for translations other people had done. And that just happened because I was the go-to person in my circle of friends when it came to editing, reviewing their master's thesis, their diploma thesis. So at the end of their studies, everybody in my native Germany had to write a longer paper. And they would come to me and say, hey, can you make sure that all the spelling is correct, because at that time we didn't have all the nice spelling features in editors that people would use on computers. I probably proofread quite a few that were still written on a typewriter. And so this friend of mine was offered a job in proofreading, and she said, I'm not that great, but I know the person that you should get for that. And so I started just copy editing text. I learned that there was something like called a style guide, and also like a terminology database. And I had to make sure that people would use the terminology consistently. And at some point I was like, I can do those translations myself. And then at some point I realized it was not only manuals. At that time, I hadn't even used some of the Microsoft products I was actually proofreading the manuals for. And at some point, I also realized, like, oh, maybe it would be fun to do this, like, with the software itself. So I became what they called a localizer at the time. So at that time, actually, we just started using Trados as a CAD tool. Microsoft actually onboarded Trados, I think, widely at the end of the 90s, so 97-ish. And so a lot of those tools were still very new. I love the idea of being able to recycle things, to use fuzzy matches. So that was the latest thing. And at the end of the 90s, actually, I used machine translation for the very first time. And it was very cumbersome. But I also liked the idea of, that we could innovate with the right tools. Yeah. And then the journey started through different roles, from being a translator to becoming a project manager, program manager. I had my stints in engineering a little bit. But it was a very different industry at the time, which should probably be consoling for everybody in the industry right now, because I've seen quite a few changes. I think it's an industry that never stops changing. And
but we don't take on change with open arms, I would say.
Yes. Well, we had to, right? But I'm still working in that field. So it's not that the machines replace them.
No, you're right. You're right. Now, one of the interesting things about your journey, Soren, is, and everybody, it sounds like it very interesting to the audience as well, when somebody starts at the vendor and moves to the client side. And most people work in our industry on the vendor side, and very few works on the client side, because client needs vendors to help them. And that's where the majority of the workforce in our industry sits, at the vendor side. Of course, there are many, many individuals working on the client side. But you personally went from the vendor to the client side, Microsoft being one. What was the first thing that you noticed? What shocked you? What changed from a vendor to a client side? What did you find different?
Quite a few things. I would say that obviously on the client side, you're a lot closer to the teams creating the product, and you have more influence, although I had to learn to utilize that influence and also engage those teams more and more. So the longer I was with Microsoft and the longer I was in my role, the more I saw all those opportunities of influencing the product teams. And a lot of things have to be done upstream, as we all know, right? There are certain things, like if you get bad source text, it's a little easier to talk to the writers if you're in the same organization than when you're the translator who first has to contact their project manager, who then has to contact the client, who then does that internally. So some of the routes were a little more direct. What was harder for me was basically being cut off a little bit from the downstream ecosystem. So not having that exposure to translators as much, because there was that whole ecosystem further downstream in the projects. So sometimes really not seeing, like, who are the translators? What are they specifically struggling with for the products that we give them to work on? So I think it's a little bit about, like, how the stakeholders change. What I also found interesting, especially at that time when I moved from a vendor that worked on different Microsoft projects to Microsoft itself, I actually saw that often the vendors see more what's happening across teams, and then especially since they're working often with different clients, they see more good ideas that might be sitting in different organizations, as they have different processes, as they might even prescribe certain tools. So I felt like I lost a little bit of that as I was getting more specialized and work just following one workflow, instead of having to see, like, several ones and then also seeing, like, oh, what's the best. So there's a lot of strength on the vendor side, where they can sometimes go back to their clients and say, like, hey, have you ever thought of doing it this way? And I know that vendors are sometimes hesitant of of talking to clients that way, but it's always one of the things that when I was still on the vendor side that I enjoyed, like having a little bit more of an overview.
Now, one of the things, and I don't know what your comments on this one, I always noticed in the industry, I've been in the industry for almost 25 years now. I started early 2000. I'm not sure you're familiar with the story, but I feel like I've told this story many times, but I'll say it again. I was coming back on a trip, and my background is technology. I'm a technologist by trade. And somebody sat beside me on a plane who runs a small language company, barely breaking $1 million. And he convinced me to go run his business development team 2 hour flights later. Maybe I had too much gin on the flight. I don't know. But I ended up in an industry I didn't know existed. Similar story to you. And I didn't know. I thought perhaps, you know, you need something translated. You just take a translator. You take it. You translate it. I speak three languages. So I said, oh, okay. You want something translated into French? I'll write it for you in French, whatever you want. So the key here is all of my life in the industry, the market has led me to believe that translation is an afterthought. Meaning that if you're working on a project as a customer, on the client side, and translation is not way upstream, it's way downstream. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. So imagine for the audience, if you have a project that you're working on from a content development perspective, you're building a website or you're creating a training material, you're creating a video, whatever you're creating. So you're going through the process of creating the material. But then toward the end of the project, somebody says, oh my God, we have to translate this thing. But you're way down the road. You built the house, you've put the structure, the foundation, the basement, everything is put in place now. But now we have to go translate, and some of that could reflect back on the structural way that you've built things. So that's why we call it an afterthought industry versus upstream industry, where you are involved at the initiation of the project. When you were working on the client side, did you influence this process? Did you try to change it? What was your reaction to this?
Well, I think it's a very valid point. And I think that you can see the maturity of organizations in terms of the international story when you look exactly at how they are treating translation and localization. So when I started at Microsoft, I felt like, oh, I'm just this little localizer, so there's not that much space. But several years later, I actually worked on, as you mentioned, on Microsoft Teams, and I was brought in pretty early. It was still like a very secretive product. We worked on the first version, and we had all these conversations. We talked about, like, how do we think about certain features from an international perspective? What do we need to cater for? And I could tell that Microsoft, but I also know that some of the other IT companies have reached that maturity level where it's not just an afterthought. And I think it's always part of the role of a localization team when they're internal, but also of vendors for clients where there might not be a big organization on the other side, to really educate people, especially about that fact that it is so much harder to cater for cultural differences, market differences, language differences, when you do it in the very end. It's just how you design products. And so it became much bigger part of my role to really work on that influencing thoughts upstream. I also have to say that it often depends on who you're dealing with, how easy that influencing becomes. Like, I worked on a server product where people were like, oh man, we have to really localize this. Doesn't every server administrator in the world speak English anyways? And you will just, we have a very complex product and we have to wait for you to get things localized. You're slowing us down. But then I worked with marketing organizations, and you can imagine, like, they vet every source word very carefully. They have stories to tell, and they're super eager to make sure that those stories are being told well. And so they were the ones that would say, like, oh, bring in the folks from the localization team as early as possible so that we can talk about, like, what is the story that we're telling? Will that resonate across markets? Can we get some input? So the spectrum is very wide. Sometimes you have the more technical folks where it might be really hard to convince them of the value of translation being involved early on. And then you have other teams that, because they are working with languages, that are very open to having those conversations.
Now, in the same discussion, one could argue perhaps that if we're not involved in the localization industry upstream, as close to the idea inception as possible, the process gets complicated and it starts to get costly. And in a world, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, that did not matter because people were not paying that much attention to cost at the point, at that point. But I think we've done two good and a bad jobs, right? So one bad job we've done is we've built an entire industry on a unit price called the word, which killed the industry, in my opinion. And the other part of it is we've we did very well, vendors competing with each other educated the client to the nth degree. So the client knows about the industry, and it's rightly so, you need to educate your customers, but the customers are very well aware. They're very educated. They can do it themselves in a lot of cases. They just have to put the pieces together. In my opinion, to be honest with you, especially I'd like to get your idea on this one, is if the translation process or the localization process is involved at the onset of whatever project the customer is working on, it saves money down the road.
Yes, I totally agree. And it also, well, there's the cost saving on the one side, there's also quality. I would say that I worked on one project where we brought Windows to new languages, a whole lot of minority languages, but then also languages where the market was not yet big enough for like a full version of Windows. We actually had like this 20% of the interface was localized, the most important pieces of Windows. And you can imagine there's lots of strings in a Windows operating system. And so at that time, basically every market was happy just having a localized version. They did not look that much at the quality. That changed with the next version of Windows, and people were a lot more critical. And so
expectation goes up, right, Soren?
Yes, exactly. And of course they do. And I feel it's also justified that in the beginning you're like, oh yeah, that's really awesome. I now have a Hindi version of Windows. But at some point you're like, okay, but please fix those typos and make sure that the terminology is consistent and so on. So that is an additional factor, right? So the cost, as you said, yes, if you have to fix errors afterwards and you have to go through these extra iterations, just because translators have to ask for additional context just because you don't have an automatic way of providing them with context. Yes, you add time, but you also add a lot of pitfalls that could endanger your quality.
Now, when you worked at Microsoft, though, I mean, it's well-known fact that Microsoft operates in 39 languages, at least 39 languages, the one I know about. The biggest question for somebody looking from the outside in onto that, you know, not everybody's familiar with how Microsoft operate, I guess. The people who are directly involved are the vendors who are working with Microsoft and people such as yourself who used to work for the company. But for people who are not, the audience who are not familiar with this, how does a company like Microsoft with 39 languages or 40 languages to round it up to translate or to localize to, how do you maintain consistency of brand voice across many languages and many vendors? I'm assuming they're using many vendors, not just one vendor.
So, well, you do need a good linguistic strategy and a language quality strategy. I actually worked on that for a team for several years. You need to make sure that people have the right guidance from the get-go. So starting with style guides, starting with terminology. So good terminology work is obviously very, very important. There's a centralized database for all products that people use during translation. But then there's also like the whole, you want to have like a very smoothly working infrastructure localization pipeline, right? So that you can exactly focus on some of that upstream work, but then also on supervising that language quality work. And as you say, like it's actually different language sets for different products. But like the round 40 is true for many, many products. Although there's some, there's even more, and then there's somewhere it might be slightly less. You need to scale out your processes, right? And that is often a big challenge, really making sure that you can have like your reviews on samples of a vendor's work, for example, that you can do that for that whole big language set.
Now, for the audience, one of the projects that Soren is really involved in, and it's close to him quite well, and that's why I wanted to do this podcast with him originally, is the Mayan language and under-resourced language, MT. Soren, you're working on a project right now for the preservation of the Mayan languages, specifically exploring synthetic data generation to support machine translation for Kwikshi, I guess, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, or Kiikshi. Can you walk us through the problem that you're trying to solve? First, congratulations. That's very well worthy cause. Every time humanity try to save another language, it's a battle to win. And we're all rooting for you. If you need any support, any help, hopefully this podcast can help you. But that's a great cause, in my opinion. I mean, there are many languages out there rarely spoken, I mean, or spoken by a small number of people out there. And, you know, the idea of those languages disappearing after the current generation is not speaking them anymore makes absolutely no sense to anybody. I mean, there are in history many languages that are not spoken anymore or spoken by very few. But preserving them is a good cause. To you.
Thank you. Yeah, and I do want to give the project a little bit of visibility. So thanks a lot for having me on the podcast. And I cannot pronounce the name of Kwikshi properly either, because there's two of those dotted stops in them that you actually Kwikshi mark with something like the apostrophe. And
there's two apostrophes. There's one after Q. There's one at the end after I.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm not good with a glottal stop, so I won't try. But the good thing is I don't need to speak the language to to be working with it. So that is our pilot language for a whole set of different Mayan languages that the Mayan Languages Preservation Project is working on. The whole idea is based on the fact that languages, and Kwikshi is even spoken by a million people, but it does not have a whole lot of digital data. So we know that most AI tools need sufficient data. Machine translation is not different from LLMs that need even more data. So we're thinking, like, how can we solve this problem of having a limited amount of data available? Very often for many, many languages that are spoken by very small communities, the few bilingual data that you have available will actually be the Bible. That is something, but you don't really want to base all your, you don't want to base your machine translation. You cannot base, even that is not enough data. And so, and it's one of these vicious cycles where people don't have a chance to use the language. They might even be lacking keyboards, and that's a slightly different story, but it's something that needs to be resolved as well. They might not have apps in which they can use their language, so there's no new digital data being created. And so there's not enough data to train machine translation. So our approach was basically create synthetic data. And we were going back kind of the opposite route that machine translation has taken. We're going back to something rule-based, implementing a system that has three major components. One being word lists, so that we have vocabulary. And I should point out that this synthetic sentence generator that creates synthetic data has output in Spanish, Kwikshi, and English. So because Spanish Kwikshi is the much more probable way that the machine translation would be used in, and also back to Spanish because it's a language spoken in Guatemala, where the main language, the majority language, is Spanish. But we also wanted to have English in the mix as well. So we, as output, we want trilingual sentence triplets. So we would have word lists that are also trilingual, a list of nouns, which we got from the community, a list of verbs, and so on, with a little bit of additional information. Sometimes you have a verb that is irregular in one of those languages, right? English likes to have some of the more used words are irregular. So capturing the go, went, gone, like those irregular verb forms. But then for nouns, you might have sheep and then the plural inexplicably is sheep and not sheeps. So capturing some of that morphological information, but then also a little bit of semantic information. So you have these word lists, then you have sentence templates that basically just say, like, put these words together in this order. So let's say we build a set of sentences that say...
That's the rule-based one, right? Is that the rule-based?
That is already rule-based, but we will come to more rules even in the third piece. So you have these sentence templates, so the, like, I am some adjective, so you can stick into the adjective slot, you can put tall, small, friendly, and so on. And that's where a little bit of semantics comes in, so that you don't use adjectives that are not suitable for humans. And then you have a morphologizer. So that's where most of the rules come in, some of the grammatical rules that basically tell you what do you do. Like in Spanish, an adjective for a noun has to be congruent with that. Like if you have a masculine noun, right, you also have to have the masculine form of the adjective. You might need to have inflections. Even in English, you have like if it's Robin's basket that we're talking about, right, you have to have put that apostrophe S at the end of Robin. So all these rules, grammatical rules, need to be encoded in scripts. And so basically, the synthetic sentence generator looks at a template, says, oh, I need to have these different words in there. It picks words at random, adjusts them as required by the grammar for each of the languages. So that would be obviously a script for each of the languages, Kekchi, Spanish, English. And what we get out are hundreds, thousands, ten thousands of sentences. And of course, you need to have enough different templates so that you have some variety in there. And you end up with a lot of data that you then can feed into machine translation, machine translation training.
Now, there was a lot of attempt in our industry on the topic of synthetic data. There was a couple of companies, one of them in particular was from Germany, attempted that journey of creating synthetic data on a commercial scale for commercial reasons. Where data was scarce, not necessarily on the language side, which in your case, you're doing it for the under-resourced languages, but they were more focused on a specific topic. Let's say you want to train something on a specific topic that there's not much data on. Maybe the idea is brand new, or a tech invention that it hasn't hit the street yet. There's not many content around that. For those audience, what is your confidence level in who don't know about, you know, the audience that don't know anything about synthetic data? What's the confidence level between naturally acquired data versus synthetic data?
So we definitely have less confidence in the synthetically created data. We do have a review process. So you obviously need to make sure that those patterns work. And even if the patterns work in general, you have those exceptions. You try to minimize some of the exceptions. The nice thing is that you obviously can steer the process in a way where you can exclude like highly irregular constructions. And since the purpose is to have a fairly simple, to have an MT engine that can handle fairly simple constructions and not like all utterances in a language, you can also say like we don't want to have like overly complex constructions that have like three subclauses for one main clause. So yes, you obviously need to have a evaluation process for which we had some experts reviewing the output and then reiterating, because especially in the beginning, we didn't get everything right. And then slowly keep building on the system and augmenting it. You still, for the MT engine training, we still have a mix where we always feed in natural data. So we don't rely on the synthetic data alone, because that would really, would be steering things too much into one direction.
What is the project status right now, Soren? Where are you at?
We are at the state of refining the MT engine training, but still also refining the synthetic sentence generator. So we are planning on wrapping these things up. There's a paper in preparation that it will take its time to go through the academic hurdles. So we will also be presenting at least on one conference later this year about the general concept. So the proof of concept is there. So we already get some good results, but the MT engine yet is not fully reliable. I would not want to let it out into the wild. And then we also, like as we were moving forward with the project, I started working on a training for post-editing of machine translation, because as you can imagine, minority language, even if you have translators, you often have interpreters for those more than translators, but they are not trained in post-editing, right? For many languages that our industry deals with, it's a very established process. People know how to do it. It is a different skill from just translating from scratch. So we need to also invest in that. And that's another step that we have started, but we're not complete with a good solid training.
You know, the little birdie told me that you once worked on a localized product into Inuktitut. That's an Aboriginal language here in the North American continent. I think primarily Canada. I'm not sure if there's Inuktitut in the US, but I think it's a Canadian thing, which is one of the rarest languages you've ever worked on. What does it take to build localization process for languages with almost non-existing digital infrastructure as you did? And how does that connect to what you're doing right now on the Mayan language project?
So that is many years ago. That was actually when we started doing Windows. And
sorry to take you down the memory lane there, sorry.
Yeah, it was not a strong business case, but Microsoft worked with the Canadian government. Nunavut is an autonomous region, and they helped us tremendously. It was challenging. The interesting thing is that there are several pieces. I would say that Inuktitut was the language with the fewest speakers there, but we also worked with Maori, with Quechua, which is not related to Quechua in South America. But also some minority languages in Europe. And I do think that I learned quite a bit. I also learned that there are certain things that you really need to clarify from the get-go. I've had some really interesting conversations about the terminology that we picked. That is something where I would push a lot more for user input. For Inuktitut, we did get that. They were vetting new words that they introduced for internet or mouse click very, very carefully. So I learned a lot in terms of processes that I would always implement from the get-go now. But it also inspired me to actually look at those languages. I started, as I said, like on the translation side for German, which is a language that is spoken by enough people. And it was always very German and Japanese were actually the first two languages that Microsoft localized into. So I never had to worry about the status of my language, any problems, like not being served by IT, unless someone would say like we only do English. But so I definitely discovered like the importance of bringing those languages into the digital world and really opened my eyes. And since then, I've been trying to be an advocate for a lot of those languages because I do see, yes, how important it is. And I love that the language industry at large is very, very aware of the issues. It's sometimes just hard to get the expertise that many people have back to those languages, because I do see there's a lot of language work with a lot of smaller communities, and they would put a word list just flat on the internet. And then you cannot really do anything with it because they didn't even think of having a dynamic database and then slowly building that. How do we take some of the expertise that is in the language industry to communities that want to work with their languages on their languages? There are so many established processes, right? People know how to build a terminology database. It's slightly different from collecting a lexicon, but there's really good approaches on how you think about these things. And yes, so that's what I'm very passionate about, both with Translation Commons and the Mayan Languages Preservation Project.
So talk to me a little bit about Translation Commons.
So Translation Commons is an organization that is also working on supporting speaker communities of minority languages, low resource languages, indigenous languages. And there's a comprehensive agenda. We're basically thinking about how to take a language through all the stages into the digital world. So it really starts with, do you even have a writing system, which is something we haven't tackled, but the next step would be just having a keyboard available, because some languages, they need their special characters that might be slightly different from what you already have available, and making sure that a language just has a keyboard that people can then use on the common devices, right? On Windows devices, but also on Mac, on obviously on Android phones. So it takes a lot to actually work with the big IT companies who are a little bit of gatekeepers when it comes to these very basics of technology.
Excellent. And you still there, Soren?
I think I just got... Okay.
Still there? I got you.
Yes.
Don't worry. See, when you do these things online, you mean you got to live with what you got to live with. So it's part of the drama that sometimes when we... Not drama, I mean, people have worse drama than this one. If the internet connection drops a little bit, we continue on like nothing happened. So you were saying, sorry, before the connection dropped.
I was talking about keyboards.
Yes, that's right. You're converting, you know, the various types of keyboards, Android, etc. So
yes, and that's where obviously also the big IT companies have a responsibility. I wish that there was a little bit more openness, and I already wish that when I was at Microsoft to enable. Oh, and I'm dropping again.
You seem to be okay on my side.
Oh, okay. Having some of the architecture a little bit more open. I know that there's security concerns, what you can do and what you cannot do, but a lot of the platforms are very shielded, right? So it's not that you can just create your own language version of some of the most widely used apps or websites. It would be beautiful if you could just provide strings for like the Google search page and they could just put them in there. I'm digressing a little bit from translation.
That's okay. That's fine.
Agenda.
Oh, good information.
It is really about like supporting communities, helping them with figuring out how to do these things. So from keyboards to fonts, because you also need the font. It's not just the keyboard layout. You need to represent those characters. And then all the way, we still working on a paper on how to use AI, which obviously does not entail just try ChatGPT and Kekchi, because it will hallucinate wildly and not do it properly at all.
They will not produce good contents anyway. And specifically in those rare languages, am I correct?
Yes, correct. So, we're trying to cover all that. And so my current role is twofold. I'm making these materials available to different languages. There, the guidelines are normally written in English, and there's a lot of communities that will, we cannot bring it to them in their language, but at least in a language that might be their second or third language. So that is part of my role. But the other part is also training volunteers. We have lots of volunteers, but they're all, or most of them are fairly junior. It's localization PMs that might just get started with their career, or they haven't started their career. They're between school and their career, or they're at the end of school. So we want to give them the chance to get their hands dirty, run a project. So I've been supervising a few very, very inefficient projects where we had like...
Inefficient, I love that.
One PM per language, and then like a translator, a proofreader, an editor. And so like lots of PMs on the projects. I would not want to run projects like that in a regular company, but obviously for people just to learn, like, how do I coordinate a schedule? How do I talk to a translator that, because they also volunteer, don't show up? And how do I make sure that the work is being done? How do I quickly react to the fact that a resource dropped out, right? All those things that people want to learn. So I have this basically educational part. You mentioned that I'm also I have been teaching at different colleges, the longest time at the University of Washington here in Seattle. It's something that I love doing, bringing people into the industry, helping them with their first steps. And so that's part of that role as well. So I'm always looking at these two different dimensions, right? Making sure that the content for that main mission of Translation Commons is available in many languages, but also making sure that people can get their feet wet.
So do I understand this correctly? Translation Commons is a nonprofit organization?
Correct. Yes.
And how are you guys funded? How are you funded?
We have some donations, but really the most funding comes from the work that people put in and the goodwill of some organizations that would, and I will do the plug here for SmartCat that has helped us with having a translation management system. So there's the goodwill of some organizations that help us, but then it's volunteer work. And we're trying to give back. I implemented that within the first few months that I had become localization director. I introduced digital badges that people can show on LinkedIn so that they also have something that they can really present to people wondering, hey, do you have any experience? Yes, I do. I've run a few projects. Or I've done translation, like this much translation.
So having been in the industry for so many years, you've taught in so many universities, you've written books about the topic, two of them. I guess people on the audience side will value your advice when it comes to, you know, if you were to give, instruct somebody or give an advice to somebody or to someone who's just entering the localization industry today, what would be your best advice?
Keep learning. Always look at what's going on in the industry at large. I think that's probably the advice that actually people are giving for most professions these days, because we are in very chaotic times, but also times where I feel like there's a lot of opportunity. So be open when it comes to AI. As I said, like the problem that I outlined at the very beginning, the differences between people, sometimes people complain about how globalization has changed the world and everybody is the same. When you travel, you notice, no, I mean, there's still language barriers, there's still huge cultural differences. Mm-hmm. And thinking about that is just something experts will be needed for. And we should not forget that translators were always more than people who would just switch out words, right?
That's right, that's
They've
right.
Always been ambassadors for two cultures they're working on and figuring out how do these things fit. And I also do think that maybe the language industry, you mentioned the word count, we've made some clients believe that words are just a commodity and not something that that requires a lot of thinking. And as content gets more creative, and I've seen that actually during my time at Microsoft, we could use translation memories because we would have these very technocratic text where you like start, click this button, then click this button, then click this button. As things became more creative, it got more challenging again to translate with certain tools. And I think that just instilling some more of that creativity would become more and more important.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And you know, I'm participating, actually, I'm an ambassador for three conferences now. One of them is called Leo 13. It's coming up here in June. And the title of that conference is The Industry Here to Stay, Localization Here, Translators Are Here to Stay, which is a question on everybody's mind. So when you talk to young graduates or just about to graduate at universities, various countries, the biggest question is, should I continue down the road of taking my degree or should I step out because of my, you know, because of all the information that I'm hearing about AI replacing humanity or human in the or professionals in specific jobs, including translation. Now, translation is not the only job that AI is impacting. It's impacting every walks of life or every aspect of life. But when you are at a university, you are at a sort of like a demarcation point in your life, and you're now at a decision. You got to continue or switch or you know, do something completely different when it comes to evaluating what you want to do. For those who are passionate about languages and passionate about going into academia and studying and getting involved in the language industry, you know, my message and Soren's message, I guess, you know, eloquently just mentioned it earlier, the industry is here to stay. Continue down the track, continue studying, continue educating yourself, continue getting knowledge on the industry, because this industry has been around since the humanity has been around, and it will continue for as long. And why I say that, and technology will play a role, and I'm not discounting that, but humanity will play a different role at every junction of the changes, regardless of the technology. You know, I heard something the other day, Soren, somebody was telling me, a human in charge of technology. We have to step up and take charge of the technology versus wait and see if technology take charge of us. I hate the surrender approach. That's me. You know, stand up, take control of the technology, make it helpful to you, use it in your own world in the way you see fit, and stop saying that, oh, AI is taking over the world. That's got nothing to do with it. We're allowing this if we don't step up and take charge of it. What do you think?
Yes, I totally agree. I think the one thing that people should really keep in mind is that the new technology of LLMs is a technology that requires you to be able to ask the right questions. You need to have good prompts to get good results. And this learning to ask good questions requires expertise in certain areas. If you want to ask the right questions about how should this marketing text sound best in other markets, if you understand that there are differences between markets and how those look like, if you understand how language is being used, and like I'm always saying, like, you can technically become a PM in the localization world if you don't speak another language. But it's so helpful when you understand what differences between languages might exist, right? So it's the same thing here, where you need to have a certain mindset for asking exactly the right questions. So, and I fear that people just assume because we have these great tools that can give answers that solves all the problems. No, the problem has always been about asking good questions. And maybe that's where my philosophy major comes through, because philosophy is never about finding the right answer. It's always about like asking
right
the
question.
Best questions.
Absolutely. Hey, Soren, I want to thank you so much for a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed this one. What do you think?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And it's been super fun. Yes.
I really appreciate your time with me. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this conversation, Soren?
Well, you already added the encouragement for people entering the industry. I think that is super important and maybe just add the encouragement for the people who are already in the industry. Think about how
Same
you
idea.
Can creatively use the tools. As Robin said, like, don't surrender. It should not be that somebody in a product team just thinks like, oh, I'll just say like, I'll translate this to this language to an LLM, and then they get some output and they have no idea what the quality of that is. You understand all the processes involved in bringing products to the world, right? In bringing documents to the world, websites. So that is a lot that LLMs can help with, but AI is also only as smart as the people who wield that tool.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Soren. I want to thank the audience for joining me today on this journey of conversation with Soren Eberhardt. And Soren, you're welcome back on the channel anytime. You're working for a very well-worthy cause, and I would love to support you by adding me to your list of conversation podcasts anytime you want, anytime you have news to share, or anytime you have a story to tell. I love those opportunities to support the industry in a variety of ways. Again, no obligation. This is a free channel. Nobody's paying me. Just trying to do humanity a good favor here in amplifying the language messages. For the audience, I want to thank you so much for joining me on YouTube. If you're viewing us on YouTube, thanks for watching. If you're viewing us on the podcast channel. Thanks for listening in. And I also encourage you to pop over to our blog post where I summarize all these conversation in a very neatly organized blog, so you don't have to listen to the entire conversation, but you can summarize it in a Cole's Note version. It takes you 2 minutes to read. The website is robinayoub.blog. Check it out. It is very helpful. Thanks so much, everybody, and I'll see you at the next episode. Soren, thanks so much. Stay around for 1 second.